Shrink Wrap Radio Number 516, Ending the Parent-Teen Control Battle with Neil D. Brown, LCSW.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
Today, my guest is Neil D. Brown, psychotherapist and author of the upcoming 2016 book, Ending the Parent-Teen Control Battle. For more information about Neil D. Brown, please see our show notes on shrinkwrapradio.com. Before we go to the interview, let me mention that this week's featured article in The Neuropsychotherapist is Mental Health Through Exercise. You'll find it at neuropsychotherapist.com, which is the beautifully illustrated online monthly magazine for psychotherapists and anyone else interested in the intersection between the latest neuroscience findings and psychotherapy. I want you to go to neuropsychotherapist.com and get your free introductory issue today, and I'm hoping that will inspire you to support their superlative work by subscribing to it. And today's show is also brought to you by our new sponsor, Bombas.com. Save 20% off your first order at www.getbombas.com/shrinkwrapradio. Now, here's the interview. Neil D. Brown, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thanks, Dr. David. Great to be here.
Well, it is great to have you here, I must say. And we are going to be discussing your book, Ending the Parent-Teen Control Battle, which I believe comes out this fall. Do I have that right?
Yeah, the release date is October 1st.
Wow. Okay, well, that'll be here before you know it. Mm-hmm, in the meanwhile, we can get people all psyched up for it to arrive. Well, tell us a bit about your background that has prepared you to write such a book.
Okay, well, my background is a strong family therapy background, and I would say even before I went to graduate school, I was working as a teacher in a rural part of southern Colorado in a school for young people with developmental disabilities. And what I discovered was when I went out, this was a very rural area, so we would travel some dirt roads miles out to get to some very rural, non-English speaking homes, and with broken Spanish and their broken English and eating tortillas and just telling them the best we could how great their kids were and how honored we were to have them in our school, it seemed to make this huge difference. The kids perked up and seemed to like school better, and the parents would come in to special events to see the kids' artwork and have potlucks. And it just made me realize that there's a very special power in the family, and that power can go in different ways. Mm-hmm. So I went to graduate school and started in on family therapy, and I haven't really quit since. I was an avid student of structural family therapy. I went to the Philadelphia Child Guidance Center for a month and studied under the directorship of Salvador Mnuchin. Was working in Santa Cruz in as a program manager for our outpatient clinic, working with adolescents and their families. And we used a lot of the skills and techniques that were taught to us that I learned at the Philadelphia Child Guidance Center, and have continued to evolve my model ever since.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned Salvador Mnuchin, and I know that he's kind of a famous name in the world of family therapy. And I'm also aware that somehow in my own training, I don't know if it was too early or what, I missed that chapter. Maybe you can tell us, and I guess his approach is called structural family therapy. Is that what you said?
Yeah, I mean, I think there was a renaissance of family therapy that took off in the 50s. I think his earliest book with Julio Montalvo and Jay Haley was Families of the Slums, where they looked at the family structural structures and the patterns of interaction that belied those structures in Philadelphia tenement housing.
Uh-huh.
And from there, they built their model of what a healthy structure and the kinds of interactional patterns that underlined healthy structures and the kinds of interactional patterns that underlined unhealthy or symptom-based patterns.
Well, can you give us a sense of those two patterns, the healthy structure and the unhealthy structure? I'm well familiar with Jay Haley, but somehow not so familiar with Mnuchin. I'm not sure how that happened. So tell us a little bit more.
So a healthy structure is one that has enough predictability and hierarchy so that there is leadership, there are boundaries, there is expectations and clarity and someone in charge, and flexible enough to respond to the needs of individual kids.
Okay.
So a healthy structure is one that can provide the essential parental functions. So, and the parental functions would be support, nurturance, limits, and guidance.
Okay.
Those are basic structures that always have to be there.
Yeah, that gives me a sense of what you mean by structure, and certainly that approach makes a lot of sense to me. So what prompted you to write this book? I mean, there are a lot of books out there about family therapy already. What made you feel like, well, I've got something to say here?
So I've been working on, as a family therapist, as a therapist in my office here in Santa Cruz for 30 years. And during that period of time, I've worked diligently to hone in my model and to create a model that's effective for families. Now, here's the challenge, that you could be a family therapist and you could have a lot of theory and you could have a lot of technique, but it's really hard to kind of hone in on something very clear and specific about how we're going to get from here to there. Because a family therapy approach is a systemic approach. We're looking at the overall, the 1,000-foot up. How do all these parts interrelate? How do these things work together? And so in trying to just try a technique here and try a technique there and try a skill here and try a skill there, you could pretty much spend a lot of time flopping around.
Yeah.
So I've, in order to communicate, first of all, to see it myself, and then secondarily to communicate it to my family, to the families I'm working with, I'll look for that pattern of interaction that gets in the way of their moving forward, either to address a symptom or to address a behavior to help it resolve. And so the pattern, that enduring negative pattern, is something that I've termed the control battle. And what I've been able to do is help families see the control battle as the enemy and not their kid as the enemy. Mm-hmm. Help kids see the control battle as the enemy, not their parent as the enemy. Because kids and parents want more or less the same thing. They want the kid to grow up, develop independence, develop responsibility, and have autonomy. The kid wants autonomy. The parents want them to have autonomy. The parents want them to have it safely.
Yeah, yeah. Well put. Well put. I was going to ask you what you meant by the control battle, because that's a major theme that runs through the book. You know, as if I hadn't raised four kids myself. But just in case there's anybody who might be a little bit confused by what you mean as the control battle, just say a little bit more about what that tug of war is about.
Okay. So if we look at, from what we were just talking about, those negative interactional patterns that come from negative structures, that negative interactional pattern where a parent is continually pushing to try to resolve a behavior, change a behavior, get a kid to do something, get a kid to not do something, and then the kid's response to that is always to resist the parental input or the parental expectation. So parent pushes, kid resists. Kid resists, parents push. And what happens is that has a momentum. It has a life of its own. It has an energy all its own, because parents are expecting resistance and kids are expecting control. And so kids resist control, parents anticipate resistance, and then that becomes the definition of their relationship. It becomes enduring. For parents, it's extremely frustrating because they feel very much like walking on eggshells. They don't know quite how to engage their kid. They may have read books saying, oh, you should always do this, which might be thoughtful and kind. So they're being thoughtful and kind while their kid shoots them with a fire hose. You know, it's, they're not, so it gets very confusing and it gets very stuck. For parents, it's very much like they're in the side of the road in, you know, in their pickup, and their wheel is spinning in the mud, and they step on the gas and they sink deeper. They don't step on the gas and they just sit there and the problem doesn't go away. So then they step on the gas again, they sink deeper. They take their foot off the pedal and they just sit there. So it's a very frustrating thing for parents and kids.
Yeah, I like that metaphor. Mm-hmm. And we are focusing on the teens in the teenage years here. So what would be an example of a typical control struggle that you encounter in your work?
Okay, well, a typical one for most therapists or families is parents say, for instance, wanting their kid to do their homework and the kid wanting to do everything but their homework.
Yeah, okay.
And so parents say, hey, come on, sit down, let's get this going. And the kid goes, okay, and then look around, they're on YouTube and they're texting their friends and they're, you know, doing something else. And then the parent, you know, goes in and prompts them again. The kid says, okay, and then resists them again. So that's a common kind of pattern that might go on for 6 months or a year or years. Another common pattern is one that might be less behavioral acting out, and it might be behavioral acting in, where there's a child who's got some tendencies towards depression, and the parents are saying, well, sweetheart or son, why don't you do this? And then the kid goes, you don't understand, you don't care about me. And then they hold up in the room and the parent tries to show them that they care and tries to give them solutions to their depression. And they, why don't you call Jenny and you guys go do something? You don't understand, Jenny hates me and all her friends don't like me anymore and I'm just going to sit here. And so the parent keeps pushing solutions and the kid keeps resisting solutions. And so whether it's an acting out kind of thing where that involves drugs or alcohol or not doing responsible behaviors or responsibilities, or it's one where a kid is withdrawn and not taking care of themselves. Either way, the control battle becomes the pattern of the relationship.
Yeah, well, those are great examples. I'm sure that people in my listening audience will recognize those if they have kids, teenagers, mm-hmm. and so good examples. Now, you refer to the struggle as the beast.
I do.
Yeah.
I do.
So what was your thinking there? Why is it personified as the beast?
Well, you know, at the expense of being either trite or tricky by introducing this concept, I feel like it gives a clarity of vision, because you can't fight what you can't see. So if we've got a control battle, that's a pattern, and no one can quite see a pattern that they're in. But if they can see this thing that I'm calling the beast, which to me is kind of like Jabba the Hutt, who sucks all the energy out of the universe. And so you might say the beast sucks all the energy out of the family, because parents are putting a lot of energy, and usually they're putting an extreme amount of energy into the child that they're in a control battle with. And the child's putting a lot of, or the teen's putting a lot of energy into resisting the parental control. So a lot of energy is going in, but the beast is sucking it up. So if I can create a personification and they can begin to see what it is, they can create a visualization of what's benefiting from their efforts. It's not them who's benefiting from their efforts. It's the beast that's benefiting, and the beast is this semi-invisible creature in the corner of the therapy room or in the corner of their family room that's just sitting there silently laughing and bloating up as they engage the control battle pattern.
Yeah, I love that. And taking from what you said earlier, it seems to me another really great function of having this personification of the beast is you're not blaming the kid, you're not blaming the parent. It's sort of almost an autonomous thing separate from them.
Exactly. And so if we take that concept where parents aren't blaming kid and kids aren't blaming parent, then we can create an alliance between parents and kids. And we can say, okay, you guys work together and let's defeat this outsider.
Yeah.
So you can, you know, you can see it in countries that when nothing unifies a country more than being at war with an outsider. So if we take parents and kids and put them at war with the beast, now they've got something else to blame, and they can work together to accomplish that.
Yeah. You know, something that comes to mind that's a little bit out of the flow of the book, but a question about family therapy and being a family therapist is sort of throughout the book, it's sort of as if there's only one teen. But one of the challenges of being a family therapist, which my hat's off to you as a family therapist, I mean, I think it's very challenging. What if there are more than one teen? So that would complicate issues greatly.
It does complicate things. Let me first say that if it's a family with three members, family with four members, a family with seven members, everybody's in the family and everybody is in the pattern in one way or another. So whether in a family we have, let's just hypothetically say we've got three kids, three teens in various stages of their adolescence, and one that's really a struggle. Well, the other two are still engaged anyway. One might be choosing to be the good kid so that it kind of calms the waters in the family, and that's at the expense of their own developmental health. Another teen might be doing well but having very little to do with the family, looking to get all their needs outside the family because the family is just too much of a struggle, mm-hmm. too uncomfortable because of the sibling-parent control battle. So that youth is going to be impacted as well. And if there's, you know, I've seen families where three kids and the parents are in a control battle, and we can just recruit everybody in the family to defeat the beast and see how the beast is impacting everybody. So, you know, it's the concept applies, and yes, it gets a little bit more dynamic. And often I'll start my work with the teen that is the focus of the control battle. The one that's got the parents' concern, or the one with the most at-risk behaviors, just for efficacy, just so I can get some improvement, so I can get something going that's positive. Once I get some positive momentum, then I can bring in other family members and we can deal with some of the collateral damage of the control battle.
Oh, you mean you might just meet with the parents and that identified problem teen?
Yes.
For a while?
Okay. For starters,
to get a more controlled setting.
Yeah,
that makes sense. Mm-hmm. That makes sense. Is there something about adolescence in itself that invites the control battle? At 2 years of age, kids start trying to assert their autonomy, famously. What is it about adolescence?
Okay, well, the concept applies to kids of all ages, but the reason I focus my book on adolescence is because the stages of adolescence are so unique. Developmentally, what we're trying to accomplish with adolescents in supporting their development is different than we're trying to accomplish with kids. With adolescents, we're really preparing them to go out into the world. That's their task is to develop the independence and autonomy and sense of responsibility and identity and goals to move them forward in their lives when they separate from their families, usually in our culture at about age 18, where they either go off to college or go off to some other enterprise. And not that that always happens, but I think that's the challenge, is that because parents are going to lose legal control and legal responsibility after the age of 18.
You mentioned the stages of adolescence, and in the book you delineate three stages, cleverly named early, middle, and late.
Yeah, right.
Tell us a little bit about each of those three.
Okay. Here's how I would describe it. I think of it as a footbridge, kind of a curved footbridge that connects the land of childhood to the land of young adulthood. And in between, we've got this footbridge that kids are going to travel over. So if you take a young teen, a 12, 13, 14-year-old, they're just starting up onto that bridge. And what they're doing is they're beginning to take steps away from their family, away from their identity as a family member, and more towards their identity in their peer group or individual identity. Whereas in childhood, their friends were their classmates or their neighbors or their siblings, cousins. In early adolescence, their friends are kids who have similar interests, similar skills, similar identity, wear similar clothing, listen to the same kind of music. So they're beginning to move in that direction. And for them, the energy is more about that beginning phase of adolescence. They can't really see the world of young adulthood yet. They haven't gotten to the top of the bridge. They're just kind of looking up the bridge, and they're saying, oh my God, I have to become a teenager. How do you do that? Oh, I guess I have to wear this and act this way, and this is what's cool, and I better get myself on social media so everybody knows who I am and thinks I'm important and doesn't forget me. So that's the land of early adolescence.
Yeah, great.
I
love the way you're making it so contemporary with social media.
Well, that's what it's all about. Yeah. That's how kids are relating these days. Yeah. That's how defining themselves and esteeming themselves. Yeah. And then we get to the top of the footbridge, and that's where our 15-year-olds are, our high school sophomores for most intents and purposes. And this group is, they've accomplished what it means to be a teenager. They know their music. They know their friends. They know who they are. And they're solid in their adolescence for the most part. And they can see the land of young adulthood, but it's pretty far off in the distance. They haven't quite started on that journey to young adulthood yet. And then they can look back at childhood and they can say, see it, but it looks pretty far away. So they're right there in the middle in adolescence, not too worried about where they're going or even that grievous about where they came from. They're just kind of right there in the middle. And sometimes that can be a pretty tough age because they're just not, you know, they're not as connected to parental expectations as perhaps a younger teen might be. And they're not as fearful of their future or motivated by their future as perhaps an older teen might be. So a lot of parents have trouble with their teens at about age 15. And that can begin to smooth out at age 16. Speaking in broad generalities, of course, but that can begin to smooth out at 16 when kids begin to say, oh my Lord, I've got 24 months to legal adulthood. I better get my act together here. And they get somewhat motivated by the prospect of their future. And so that becomes a motivating factor for them. Not that they can't be in control battles with their parents. It's easy to get into those anyway, particularly if there was one earlier. But, you know, they can begin to see themselves as a little big for their britches, and they can see themselves as no longer accountable. After all, I'm going to be a young adult moving away from home, so why do you bother setting limits with me anymore? So there can be lots of opportunities for control battles with that age group, too. But they do have this sense of they're going someplace, and sometimes it can be quite frightening.
Yeah, another element of this conflict that you talk about is that there's a mismatch between the brains of the parents and the brains of the adolescent, and you go kind of into some of the neuroscience of the adolescent brain. Take us through that, if you will, here.
Okay, well, adolescence is a real metamorphosis of neurodevelopment. That's when a lot of changes happen in brain function. I can't hold myself out as an expert in neurodevelopment. I might refer listeners to Daniel Siegel or someone like that who's written extensively on the subject. But during adolescence, there's a streamlining and a movement from being a generalist in the brain to being a specialist in the brain. So those things that kids do become neuro tracks that get myelinated, and myelin allows information to move very quickly among neurons in the brain. So it builds these very fast connections. So those things that kids do, whether it's music or sports or math or science or any activity, skiing, those things become part of the brain, and that becomes like a memory in the brain and a specialization in the brain that now is there, and it's there on a fairly permanent basis. So those skill sets that kids are learning are really getting myelinated and getting specialized. And then the brain also increases its pruning function so that it starts to prune back those functions that they're no longer using or seem to need. So if they're not haven't studied a foreign language, maybe it's going to be harder for them to study a foreign language once they get into adulthood or haven't done certain behaviors. Like I didn't start skiing until late, and so my skiing is limited.
Me too.
by what I could learn as an adult, but because I took my kids skiing when they were age 2 or 3, those kids, ski as easily as they walk, and they can miss it for 3 or 4 years, and then they can get up on the slope, put on a pair of skis, and go banging down the bumps like there's no tomorrow. So it's, our brains do specialize. And of course, then there is that executive function, the neocortex, which is our ability to abstract think and think logically and use imagination productively, and where we make healthy decisions, where we think of the long-term consequences of short-term decisions. And that's growing in the adolescent brain as well and is not fully developed. So at the same time that they can think of a good logical argument with their parent about why they should have a privilege they can't quite see the long-term negative consequences of their own thinking. So that's another function that's happening. I would also add that there's this neurotransmitter called dopamine, which many of us have heard of, which is a feel-good kind of neurotransmitter, and there's an abundance of dopamine in the adolescent brain. And the adolescents will look for that dopamine hit. And so their behavior can be very influenced by the anticipation of dopamine. So they look for excitement, and they can be impulsive, and they can make decisions that have a lot of short-term reward without a lot of regard for long-term implications.
Yeah. But just you're talking about that, pardon me, I'm going to cough here. I can almost remember the extreme excitement of being a teen, that everything was exciting,
And if it wasn't, it was boring.
Yeah, right. And you say that some parent-teen struggles are actually healthy. How can one tell the difference of what's potentially a healthy struggle and one that's not?
Okay. Good question. It's a very important question. And readers can actually go to my website and download a PDF that will help them make that distinction about whether they have a real control battle in their family or not. But the simple answer to your question is it chronic or not? So if everything is you anticipate a problem for every discussion that's going to come up about a privilege or a need or a want or a choice or a parental request or an adolescent request, If you anticipate that problem and there's always going to be a problem and we're never going to get through it, that's a control battle. Particularly if we start to see symptoms in the team, then we can also anticipate that it's a control battle. Why parent-child struggles are important is a teen has to advocate for themselves. They have to be able to say, hey, I'm ready for this. I want this. Can I have this? I want to do this. That's part of their energy. It's part of their vision. It's part of their development. They need to advocate for themselves, and they're not fully skilled in it, so they're not going to call a meeting with their parents and open up a whiteboard and say, hey, I've got an idea and I'd like to present it to you. They're going to do it in some silly way and maybe just start doing it and wait for the parents to ask for forgiveness rather than permission. Or they might ask for permission and then scream bloody murder when the parents start to ask for conditions. Like, I want to go to this party. Okay, well, whose party is it? And is there a parent supervising? Can I call the parent? Oh, you're going to make me look like a baby. Nobody calls parents anymore. You guys are the most conservative, mean parents in the whole world. Well, we're not, but we do care about your safety. And no, you're not going to go to a party where there's drinking and it's lack of supervision. So if I can speak to the parents, we can do this. If we can't, we can't. Well, I'll give you their number. Just tell the parent not to tell them you called. You know, so that's kind of how it goes. And then they get through it, and then they get on to something else. In the meantime, can you take out the garbage? All right, you know. And they're mostly doing their homework and doing good things. And there's healthy parts to the relationship as well.
Yeah, yeah, great. In the book, you give an example of a mother-son control battle titled Cameron. I don't know if you remember it or not, but maybe you could take us through the highlights of that here.
I do remember, I do know it, and I can't remember the highlights of that particular.
Okay. Well, if there are other examples that come to mind, feel free to throw them in as we go along. You, on the flip side, you say that control battles can have a very destructive impact. And what are you getting at there?
Okay, well, you know, when families are coming in with their teenager or their child, for that matter, to see a therapist, it's usually because there's something serious going on. So the serious issue could be substance abuse. It could be underperformance or school failure. It could be self-cutting, eating disorders. It could be depression. It could be anxiety. It could be runaway behavior. It could be just, you know, how do I get my kid to clean up after himself? We've been fighting about this and we want to come and talk to someone about it. So from anything from mild to moderate, these are things that have to be, you know, taken very seriously as mental health behavioral problems that can have a long-term impact. Think about it. If a kid is growing up and that kid is in his relationship with his parents, is putting most of his energy into resisting what they have to say, well, that's what they're going to get good at. They're going to get good at arguing, resisting. They're going to get good at developing a negative identity. They're going to get good at distrust. They're going to get good at irresponsibility and avoiding responsibility. So they're building exactly the wrong skill set that we want them to have. And in the meantime, as I mentioned earlier, there's collateral damage to other siblings. And then there's this thing called parental burnout. And if you think about it, if you put a lot of energy into trying to accomplish something, and as much energy as you put in, it always goes bad. You can't do anything right. It's your responsibility, so I'm going to give you a responsibility, Dr. David. I'm going to say, hey, you have to accomplish this. And you say, sure, how do I do it? And I say, well, I don't know, but you have to do it. And everything you try fails, and you care about it, but you can't be successful with it. Well, that's a formula for burnout, when you have all the responsibility and no tools or movement towards success. Mm-hmm. And so parents can suffer burnout. And burnout is a real thing. Burnout can be anxiety, depression, sleeplessness, loss of confidence, distrust. It's a real energy drain and a real serious condition for many parents.
Yeah, I'd never thought to apply the concept of burnout to being a parent. I mean, usually it's in the context of a job. We talk about job burnout, but mm-hmm. being parent a parent is kind of a job too.
And many parents that come in to see me with their teens or children that they're in a struggle with are struggling with burnout, which makes them less effective. So if I say, okay, let's move in this direction, they go, I don't have the energy for that.
Yeah. We've already been around that and around that and around that, and I just don't have the energy to do that again.
Yeah.
Now, going back to the beast, I take it you actually use that metaphor with your clients, right? So that they also talk about the beast.
Many times.
And you've got a section on what feeds the beast. So what is it that feeds the beast? You list some factors.
Okay, well, there are a few factors that I've identified pretty commonly that feed the beast. And once again, I mean, I think we're all guilty of some of these behaviors to some extent. There's no such thing as a perfect parent, and there's no such thing as perfect parenting. So for whatever reason, there are a few things that tend to feed the beast that I'll identify. One is reactivity. So when parents react very quickly to what their teenager is saying or doing, and then the teenager reacts to the parent's reaction very quickly or intensely, now we've got two entities both in reaction, and in a sense they're both giving their power away to the other person. They're giving the other person the lead, and now they're being the follower. So when there's reactivity, no one's really in charge, and no one's really making a thoughtful, calculated response. So, and there's a lot of reasons for reactivity. I think most significantly is temperament. You know, some people are just tend to be a little bit more reactive in their basic temperament. Mm-hmm. That's, you know, a little more sensitive or a little more competitive, or just that's just their basic temperament. So kids and parents can have those qualities that create a negative synergy right there. I think a tendency to take things personally is a way that encourages reactivity. So if my kid is being disrespectful, rather than saying, that's kind of disrespectful, I think we better talk about this, it can be, how dare you say that to me? And then the kid kind of goes, well, you weren't respectful to me, and we can go off to the races and start to build a control battle on that basis. So reactivity, I think, is a big one. Another important one is this concept that I call being other person focused. So rather than a parent just focusing on their role as parent, what they're focusing on is changing their child or their teenager's behavior. So what I'm doing is intended to change you. Mm-hmm. And then what a kid feels when they feel like someone's trying to change them or make them do something different is they resist that, because now they feel like they don't have choice. So they get caught up in this comply and feel like a stooge of the parental expectation, or resist the parental expectation.
So that sounds like a tricky one, because I would think that most parents, or at least a lot of parents, would see themselves as part of their job is to maybe change is not the right word, but steer or get them to, change their behavior. Get them.
That's exactly what parents
this.
Say.
Yeah.
Because the parents will come in and they'll say, well, you know, the probation officer says I have to do this with my kid. I have to get my kid to school and I have to get him off drugs. What am I supposed to do? And so it is a paradoxical situation that the more they try to change their child's behavior, the more they're going to invite resistance. And so in order to fully answer the question of how do you deal with this paradox of needing your child to change a behavior but not changing their behavior, we have to move over to the next part of my book of the two skills or the two tools for getting out of a control battle.
Okay, so let's do that then.
Okay. So the two tools for moving forward and changing, getting out of a control battle are, number one, having a positive vision of your team. Because once we're into a control battle, invariably parents have come up with a negative narrative about their team. They're stubborn, they're disrespectful, they're uncaring, they're irresponsible, they're mean, they're unempathetic, whatever. They've come up with a negative narrative about their kid. They might know in their hearts that it's a, that they love their kid, but they might have started to lose faith in their kid, and somehow that gets communicated in their behavior. The more, if for instance, if I'm trying to change my kid's behavior, then I'm essentially saying to my kid, you don't have the judgment or the capability of changing your own behavior. So it's so I'm essentially communicating a negative message.
Yeah.
So we want, and so number one is getting a positive vision and communicating a positive vision of your teenager. So a way that might work, for instance, is let's just say you've got a kid who is not managing their school responsibilities. And rather than going, well, darn it, you're going to start managing your responsibilities right now, young man. Get over here and start your homework. You'd say, hey, look, I know you're perfectly capable of doing your homework. I've seen you do it 1,000 times. You're smart. You're creative. And even if there's a subject that's hard for you, I expect you to give it your best shot. You're perfectly capable of that. You're smart. You're responsible. You're a capable young person. And I need you to do your responsibilities. And you need you to do your responsibilities because that's in your own best interest. So that's a way, in, for instance, that you might communicate a more positive message to your kid.
Yeah, so it was still very assertive, I notice.
Yes, exactly.
Not quite as negative a tone as the first example, but still very strong and assertive.
I appreciate your observing that, because I think that's really important, is that we can be extremely positive at the same time that we can still hold parental leadership and parental authority. So I think being very assertive and with our message of faith and a healthy vision, I think is an important way to think about it. Exactly.
In terms of actually conducting family therapy around this, would you give the parent that instruction within the family group, or would it be a separate meeting? You know, that, hey, you need to learn to have a positive vision of your kid. Would that be a private communication with the parents, or would it be to the whole family?
Well, you know, family therapy is an art form. So you can't really say how you're going to paint the canvas each time because, you know, you're painting a different picture and you're working with a different medium each time. Mm-hmm. So it's sometimes one and sometimes the other. But I'm not afraid of playing with an open hand. I would explain how the beast has stolen their healthy vision of their kid, and I would say, when your teenager was 10, what would you have said about who they are and what their talents are? And they would have said, oh, well, you know, he's a great kid, he's athletic, you know, he's fun-loving, he gets along with everybody, he was entertaining, everybody laughed at his jokes, he was always a clown, we just loved him, he was fabulous. Well, what happened? Well, you know, Well, he's the same kid. So let's go back to his essential nature. And I want you right now to tell your kid all those things that you hold dear about him. And I might, you know, just do it right then and there. And I just say, I'll blame the beast. You know, the beast stole your positive vision from you.
Yeah, great, great.
So that's one. That's step number one in moving forward. Then step number two is a very important concept. It's the concept of privileges are earned. So rather than when a kid does something wrong and the parents give them a consequence or punish them, when a kid does something wrong, it puts into jeopardy their privileges, because privileges are based on their ability to manage them responsibly. Manage their lives responsibly, manage their relationship with their parents responsibly, manage their choices responsibly. So when they move in a direction where they're in a control battle and now they're not doing their basic primary responsibilities very well at all, they're resisting those, including self-care, then a parent can say, well, you know what? You're not earning your privileges. I want to give you these privileges. You want this, you want that, you want the other thing. I'm on your side. I want you to have those things because I love you and I want you to be happy and I want you to be successful. And quite frankly, you are going to have those things. But today, for whatever reason, you're telling me by your behavior that you haven't, that you're not really ready for them, that you're not earning them. And we could talk about what's going on, why that might be. And as soon as you are ready to get back on board and earn these privileges, you'll have them. So it's that simple. Parents will then challenge me and say, well, Neil, look, the same thing. I'm taking them away, whether I'm taking away a privilege or I'm giving them a consequence. It's the same thing. And I'll say, well, it's actually not. Because what you're saying is the solution here lies with your team. They're the ones that have the opportunity here to re-earn their privilege. You can't get them to do it. And if you take away their driving privileges for a month, that's no different than just putting them in the county jail for a month and popping them out again. What did they learn in there? They didn't learn anything in there. And they weren't told to learn anything in there. They just got punished. And so you're not telling your kid you have to go back and earn your privilege. You're just taking it away for a month. So it's almost like you're doing something to them. They're at the effect of your meanness. You're the mean parent taking it away.
Yeah.
Give it back to me. That's mine. Well, no, it's not. You're going to lose that for a month. You're just being mean. You're just being irresponsible. You're not going to have it. Yes, I am. No, I'm not. Yes, I am. And that's a control battle. Mm-hmm. So a way out of that control battle, say, hey, I'm on your side. You can have it. You just need to earn it.
Yeah. In fact, you've got a couple of formulas that you put in your book. One was responsibility plus accountability equals trust. And the other one was what you're just talking about, trust plus age equals privileges.
There you go.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. I guess those formulas pretty much speak for themselves.
And I do write them on the whiteboard for families.
Uh-huh.
I like using my whiteboard because kids are pretty visual. I think we're all kind of visual, and you can just yabber away and have a lot of talk. But once you start to draw things on the whiteboard, it makes them a lot more real. And kids and parents will stand up and take pictures of whatever it is we draw on the whiteboard so they can refer to it later.
Oh, great, great. Yeah. Do you think today's kids are more entitled, that they have more of a sense of entitled than when we came up?
Yes. I think they do. I think there's a media presence that says this is what you should be having, and we're in charge, not your parents. Mm-hmm. A media presence that says you're supposed to be having fun and doing all these things. And then we as parents, who many of us who grew up in a time when parenting was much more authoritarian. And we didn't want all that authoritarianism for our kids. And in many ways, I think we fail to set limits and structures because we're so busy building their self-esteem and telling them how wonderful they are, not holding them accountable to clear values and clear standards. So, yeah, I think there is. And then I think parents are busier, too. So parents, there's less parenting going on. We've got parents in my community. Parents are traveling from Santa Cruz over a mountain pass over to Silicon Valley. And that's an hour and a half commute each way in the rush hour. And so parents are leaving it at 6 and getting home at 6. And then it's and then it's hurry up and do this and do that and go to bed. So I think there's actually less family time, mm-hmm. less active family time going on. And kids are getting raised in their own peer groups and in after school clubs and sports activities and other activities, but much less family time.
Yeah, yeah. And something that I'm noticing more and more is parents staring at their cell phone. They might have a little toddler there, you know, in the pram or something, or even walking with them, but the parents have got their face in their cell phone, not paying attention to their child.
It's absolutely true. I'll go to the park some mornings. I like to do a little workout on the playground equipment, and then I'll see parents there with their little kids, and they'll go, Mommy, Mommy, look at me, look at me, look what I'm doing, and they'll kind of look up. Oh, that's nice, sweetheart, and look down, and they're back out. Exactly. And the kid is, Mommy, Mommy, look at me. And kids need that. They need to be seen. They need to they need to be mirrored. They need to enthrall their parents. They need that sense of who they are to come from parent appreciation of who they are. Which brings me, back to that earlier point about having a positive vision of your kid. you know, teenagers in particular have so much insecurity now that they have to fit in with their peers, and they're so obsessed with being cool and being liked and being okay. When their parents lose faith in who they are or communicate a negative vision of who they are, they already have a negative vision of who they are out of their own insecurities, and they really need us as parents to hold that healthy vision for them until they get their feet on the ground with their self-esteem, until they get stronger in their sense of who they are.
Yeah, yeah. In fact, you talk about self-esteem in the book, the kids' need for self-esteem, and so there was something you said earlier. There was a little bit of a potential conflict.
Yeah, there's like there really are two parts to self-esteem, and I think a lot of parents have the first part, which is to give your kids support. And praise. And I think when kids are young, parents are giving a lot of support and praise. And I think they've got that, and that's how it should be. And I think notwithstanding there's cell phones and computers, there are actively telling their kid that they love them and that they're special in ways that our parents probably didn't tell us every night how much they loved us and how special we are. I think we're doing a better job of doing that for kids and resourcing them and getting them things they need and making them feel loved and special. What we don't do as well is hold them to standards.
Yeah, so, we want them to have self-esteem, but it's not automatic either. It's earned to some degree. I mean, when they're real little, they don't have to earn it. But yeah, as they get older, there is the whole issue of accountability.
Yeah, and I think kids feel better about themselves when they're good at something, when they do a good job. Like, I'll have a kid, for instance, who's not doing their homework and they're being irresponsible and they're smoking weed, as they call it now. You can't call it dope. They're smoking weed. And then, you know, do these kids feel good about themselves? Absolutely not. Mm-hmm. And then we'll make a change, and pretty soon they're getting drug tested. And we've got a structure in place for them to do their work, and they start doing well, and they can think clearly, mm-hmm. and we'll say, well, how do you feel now? Oh, I feel so much better. I feel so much better.
Yeah, relevant here too is that you advocate the setting of high standards.
Absolutely, high standards that are relevant and realistic. Yes, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, there's our communities where if a kid doesn't have a 4.5 average, that their parents are upset with them. Anything less than an A in an advanced class is unacceptable. And that's going the other way. That's not acceptable either, because that creates anxiety, and it does away with creativity, and it does away with individuality. And it's all performance-based and not human-based. But where I think a lot of families come in is that their kids have not developed competencies, basic competencies in anything. So, like, all kids don't have to be stellar students. That's not the deal. If they're putting in a solid effort and getting B's and C's, that's okay. There's nothing wrong with that. But what else are they good at? What are they putting their energy into? Are they athletes? Are they musicians? Are they artists? Are they are they involved in a cause? Are they involved in a program? Are they involved in something? Are they involved in theater arts? Or there's something that they can hang their identity on or their skill on, and that they can then feel good about and know that they're accomplished and can they can be recognized outside of their families as being competent and accomplished in something. Yeah. It's very important for kids to have that. I'll have parents say, I'll say, well, kid, what are you into? What do you like to do? Well, nothing. Do you play guitar? Well, I got a guitar, but, you know, I didn't stay with it. And then, do you go for a sport? Well, you know, I went out for baseball, but, you know, I didn't like sitting on the bench. I didn't stay with it. Okay, well, what did you do? Well, I skateboard a little bit, but, you know, mostly I hang out with my friends. I like my friends. That's what I do. I hang out with my friends. I like my friends. So, and then I'll say to parents, well, what's the deal? You know, what's gone on here? And they'll say, oh, well, he never liked to stick with anything.
So where do we go from there? You've got us on a precipice.
Yeah. It's like, oh, okay. Well, in my memory, you know, kids did stick with things because parents said, you're sticking with things. Uh-huh. No, you can't quit the team. You join the team. You're part of a team. You don't like sitting on the bench, talk to the coach and get better. Yeah.
Okay. You've got a section called the talk, and that seemed like really important, the talk. Mm-hmm. So where you, I guess, are instructing the parents in a talk that they need to be able to deliver to their kids.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about the talk.
Okay. Well, clearly you've read the book because these are like the critical elements. And thank you, Dr. David. I appreciate it. So the talk is a way to take what that positive vision of your kid and moving to from consequences to privileges and putting it into a shift moment. Because there's already a momentum with the control battle. The control battle is what runs everything. So if you make a change, the control battle might resist that. And so what I look for is let's do a major shift. Let's have the talk and let's push restart in our relationship. Mm. And so what I have designed, and it works very effectively in the families that I'm working with when we need to make a big shift. And what we'll do is I'll have the parents sit down with the kids. They'll have their talking points, and they'll say, all the cell phones are away, media's away, nothing's on, not on buzz or silent, but away. And now we're just with ourselves. And parents will say to the kids the following, you, dad and I, or mom and I, think the world of you, kids or kid. We think you're fabulous for the following reasons. And then I'll have them list out all those things that are wonderful about their kid and take plenty of time to do this. And then they'll say, unfortunately, here's some things that are going on and have been going on for some time that are absolutely unconditionally unacceptable. And they'll point out these critical features. Then what I'll have the parents do is take responsibility for their part of that problem. And so the parent might say, I owe you an apology. And the kid will go, oh, well, this is starting to sound pretty good here. My parents are going to apologize to me. I may have given you the impression that it's okay to be that way. Mm-hmm. And I fought with you. And fighting with you is not what I wanted to do. It's not what I should be doing. I should not be fighting with the child I love. You're fabulous, and why am I fighting with you? And I'm trying to change you. It's not my job to change you. You're perfectly capable of changing yourself. I haven't had enough faith in you. I haven't given you the opportunity to screw up, and I haven't, in so doing, I haven't given you the opportunity to be successful on your own. I've taken way too much of this on. I've taken your behavior on myself instead of my behavior on myself. So, going forward, there needs to be some changes here, but they're entirely up to you. The changes I'm going to make is I'm not going to change you. The change I'm going to make is I'm going to let you know what the expectations are. And I'm going to let you know what the privileges are. And you can either earn the privileges or not. That's okay with me if you don't earn the privileges. Because if I don't give you permission to fail, then I'm not giving you permission to succeed either. So success and failure belong to you. Parenting and being clear about the expectations and how much I love you and have faith in you, that belongs to me. So let's move forward on that basis. In the meantime, right now we're starting at zero. You don't have any privileges. By that, I mean, da, 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 and that might or may not be appropriate at any given time. Yeah. So in some cases it might be, yes, you have no privileges. In other cases it's going to be, you have the opportunity to hold your privileges or not based on your behaviors. So that's how we do the talk. And what it does is it implements those two critical features of parents having a positive vision of their kid and moving to a privileges versus consequences based form of accountability.
Yeah. Well, you've got a lot of great advice, such as we've been hearing here in your book. How does the reader of your book decide whether or not they need help beyond what they can get out of the book?
Well, I think parents have to be confident that their kid is growing up well, that they're on the right path. Now, no kid is going to be perfect. All kids are going to screw up. If they're not screwing up, that's a problem. Kids are, have to test their wings and they have to take risks. That's part of the problem. We don't want those risks to be fatal or dangerous or life-changing. But they're going to, they're going to make mistakes, and that's okay. But they do need to know that if they go through a period of depression, that they're coming out the other side. If they go through a period of negativity, that they're coming out the other side. If they're going through a period of rebellion, that they're coming out the other side, and that they're essentially on a healthy path. If your kid, after reading the book and applying the skills, is still not on a healthy path and you don't know what to do, get help. But get help from someone that's going to see the solution as being in part in the family. We've got too much these days of psychopharmacology being the solution or individual therapy. I'll just send my kid off for mindfulness, or I'll just send my kid off for individual therapy. They got a problem, I'll send them off to a counselor to fix it. And there's a lot of counselors who'll buy into that, and certainly the insurance companies buy into that because they don't even acknowledge family therapy very often as a viable modality.
Really? That's shocking.
Very often they'll reimburse less for it, or sometimes not at all. And they certainly don't reimburse for a 90-minute session, which is what a competent family therapy session really
is. Yeah, and family therapy clearly is more work, not less.
Exactly. Yeah. So, against the headwinds of those challenges, it really needs to be that a parent finds, they might have an individual therapist and a family therapist, that might be okay. And a psychiatric evaluation and a medication evaluation is appropriate in certain circumstances. But the family needs to be involved in the solution, because the family is the institution where kids your family is your family for life. You're always going to be in this family. Your parents are always going to be your parents. Your children are always going to be your children. And those are either healthy relationships with healthy structures and healthy patterns or not. And so if there's a problem, we need the family and the kid to be on the same page with moving forward in a healthy way.
That's a great wrap-up statement, I think. you okay wrapping it up here, or is there something else you feel like you really need to say?
No, I think you've vetted all parts of the book, and I appreciate it. I think, there are a lot of issues. I will add one last thing. I think there are issues. There can be depression. There can be ADHD. There can be other features, learning disabilities. There can be bipolar disorder. There can be serious issues that families need to take into consideration. Sometimes a healthy family pattern and a healthy family response is a big part of the solution, but not the entire part of the solution. So I don't mean to use the control battle model as a cure-all for everything, but it needs to be a part of the solution in virtually every case.
Okay, very good. Well, boy, I'm really glad that I decided to interview you, to read this book, and to get to experience you like this. So, Neil D. Brown, I want to thank you for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Nice meeting with you.
I really enjoyed this interview with Neil D. Brown. I hope you get a chance to see him in either the video clip I made or the full-length video version, both of which you can find on YouTube/shrinkwrapradio. I love how animated he became when he played the roles of parent and or teen. I think what stands out for me in this interview is his expertise in family work combined with a real down-to-earth practicality in his approach. I also appreciate the fact that he's at once authoritative and at the same time humble. Clearly, he knows what he's talking about with extensive training from the best and 30 or more years of practice. At the same time, though, I got the sense from reading his book that he's still on his learning edge. He's still developing and perfecting his model, even after all these years, not content to rest on his laurels. I really resonate with his statement during the interview that family therapy is an art. I'm sure that's true of all therapy, but I think it's especially true for family therapy, where the therapist is juggling so many balls in the air, so to speak. I love his device of personifying the parent-teen conflict as, quotes, the beast, so as to objectify it and put it out there as something of an autonomous system, so that neither parent nor child are blamed. I have to say I was shocked to learn that the insurance evidently is not covering family therapy in the same way that it does individual therapy. I think family therapy is a particularly necessary and powerful modality, one that requires high levels of skill and requires more, not less, work. Neil mentioned to me that he's planning a training workshop in the Santa Cruz area within the next month or so. Santa Cruz, California, that is. I suggest you contact him if you're interested via his website, which is neildbrown.com. I highly recommend his book, Ending the Parent-Teen Control Battle, with Neil D. Brown, LCSW, both for parents of teens and for interested therapists. As you heard, the book won't be out until October. At that time, I'll be featuring an ad for it in the right-hand sidebar on shrinkwrapradio.com. You can add a note on your calendar to get it then.
Hi, Dr. Dave. This is Jacinda Duke in Wellington, New Zealand, and I just made my second donation this week, and it feels good. And so all of you listeners out there who haven't put your hand in your pocket yet, I strongly encourage you to, so we can continue to enjoy this wonderful service that's been provided. Keep it up. Love it. Thanks.
Thank you, Jacinda from New Zealand, for that rousing call to action. Action, I say. Please join Jacinda now in helping to assure the continued existence of Shrink Wrap Radio. I'm happy to announce that we do have one new donor since the last episode, and that was last week's guest, Dr. Eve Merrim. Thank you, Dr. Eve. As I mentioned at the beginning, we do have a new sponsor, Bombas Socks. I've been a happy customer for several years, ever since I saw their pitch for funding on the TV show Shark Tank. Now they've skyrocketed to success. If you're a listener in the U.S., you can save 20% off your first order by going to getbombas.com/shrinkwrapradio. And Bombas is spelled B-O-B-M-B-A-S. And wrap is spelled R-A-P, not W-R-A-P. As I mentioned last time, our Shrink Wrap Radio app has been updated. I had hoped it would allow me to send out a brief video preview of the upcoming interview, but it didn't. So if you got a couple of attempts from me recently, that's what happened. Nevertheless, there is an app for Shrink Wrap Radio that's available for all smartphones. The app gives you convenient, portable access to the most recent 80 or so episodes. It does cost $2.99. Of course, Apple or Google or Microsoft gets about a third of that, and the rest helps me to pay the $30 a month I'm paying to keep the app available for you. Take a look at the Apps tab on our site for more information. As I mentioned before, another way you can help spread the word is to repost each new episode on whatever social media platforms you might be engaging with. I'm no social media expert and could really use your help. As I said before, I currently put an announcement up of each episode on my two Facebook pages, on Twitter, on Google+, on the Depth Psychology Alliance website, and the Neuropsychotherapist Facebook page thanks to editor Matthew Dollitz. I've also taken to posting video versions of the interviews on youtube.com/shrinkwrapradio, all one word. I think there are other platforms out there that I'm not getting to, like Tumblr, for example. So please post, repost, tweet, retweet. In fact, it's recently occurred to me to wonder if there's a listener out there with particular expertise in social media who would be willing to volunteer as our official social media person. If that sounds like you, please let me know. Finally, it's summer, and I've had the privilege of meeting some of my Shrink Wrap Radio listeners as they're passing through town. I may have previously mentioned a recent visit from my former student and teaching assistant, Sean Arlt, and his Shrink Wrap Radio listener friend, Jordana Adler. If you go to the In the Media tab on our site, you'll see a nice photo of the three of us and a brief audio I made. Tomorrow, I'll be meeting with Australian psychology podcaster Amy Fellman and her podcaster husband, Troy. Amy did such a beautiful interview with me some months back. I think it's only fair I interview her on our next podcast episode. Look for the three of us on the In the Media tab, too.
Hi, this is Neil D. Brown, therapist and author of the 2016 book, Ending the Parent-Teen Control Battle. And you're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Thank you, Dr. Neil D. Brown, whom we heard from earlier today. Now let's go to a recent email from our listener community. It's from Shirley, who writes, "Love your casts. While I'm a new listener, I've been catching up as fast as I can. It occurred to me that you might be interested in Dr. Pamela Paresky's work. I've heard her speak, and we are slightly acquainted. She's a terrific speaker." And Shirley sent me a link to Pamela's blog at Psychology Today, where you can check her out for yourself. Shirley concludes, "Thank you for your work. Warm regards, Shirley Tipton." So I think that better wrap it up for today. You can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. Remember that in addition to emails, you can also leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. And you can leave voicemail on our phone at 415-830-4014, or you can use our app for that. Thanks to today's guest, Dr. Neil D. Brown, for sharing valuable tips on ending the parent-teen control battle. My next interview will be with Australian psychologist and podcaster Amy Fellman. She did a brilliant interview with me last year on her podcast, We All Wear It Differently. Her interview podcast covers issues of interest to early career psychologists such as herself. She and her husband, Troy, are touring the U.S., and I'm meeting them for lunch tomorrow. I'll interview her via Skype next week when she's back home and the jet lag hopefully has worn off. Be sure to stay tuned for our Shrink Wrap Radio rap song, performed by Nashville musician Jeff Smith. Until next time, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
That's right. Shrink Wrap Radio. Coming at you now. Yo, everybody, let's get down. There's a new MC in town. Talking psychology interviews. Dr. Dave is all the rave. Ain't no slouch on the digital couch. He's on the pod. Podcast got the bod. Yeah. You want to be in the know? No. Talking Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. I'm talking Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. I'm talking Shrink Wrap Radio. Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. All right.
You've been shrink wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.